I'm Bob Crawford, and as always, I'm joined by Dr. Ben Sawyer. Ben, when I think about the great diplomats, the great diplomatic moments in American history, one thing that I could never imagine is my button is bigger than yours.
My button is bigger than yours. Yeah.
I mean, that's like your mama smokes your papa cigars, you know?
I know. It's hilarious. And aside from being like petty, I said recently that it's like, it reminds me of the kid in eighth grade who's got to flaunt his stuff, but always knows he's going to say that his big brother can beat you up because he knows he's not going to have to do the thumping. Somebody else is going to do it for him.
We're just coming off the Christmas holiday. The movie A Christmas Story.
Yes.
Are you familiar with it?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me? Love that movie.
Scott Farkas.
Oh, no. Farkas.
Donald Trump is Scott Farkas.
Well, I guess we're going to find out who Ralphie is, right?
That's right.
Ooh, that doesn't sound good.
No, it doesn't. So how was your break?
Man, it was great. I got a little bit of free time, I guess if you call it that. I always find something to do. Been doing a little bit of work on the house, working on stand-up. Spending time with the family, and it has been it's been incredible. What about you, Bob?
Well, my family spent time with each other. It was nice. It was nice to just kind of hang out a little bit, and now we've got snow days here in North Carolina.
Yeah, and Bob, for Christmas, you got me a Barnes & Noble gift card, which I purchased Yuri Slosken's House of Government, a 1,000-page book, a book so big that sometimes it's hard to sit and read until you're like, you know, 300 pages in where it balances well. I'm only 100 pages in. And so thank you for that. I'm loving it. Yuri Slosken's one of my favorite authors on Russian history. And Bob, I got you something.
Yes, you did. You got me an Elvis Presley t-shirt.
I got you an Elvis Presley t-shirt because the singer from Journey stole your old Elvis Presley t-shirt.
It is true. Steve Perry, when I was 16 years old at a Journey concert, I was wearing an Elvis Presley t-shirt, and it was a really cool one. Not as cool as the one you got me, Ben.
But
they did Jailhouse Rock for their encore. I threw it on. I held it up. He pointed to it. He wanted it. I threw it on stage, and he walked off with it, and I never got it back. And I was very furious. And if you're ever at an Avett Brothers concert and you throw something on stage, well, that's at your own risk. But, you know, we're going to give it back. We're not going to ask for anything from you, by the way. You come and you're wearing something that, I don't know, we covet. We're not going to take it from you, but he did.
If you want to hear this whole story, you can listen to the episode that Bob and I did on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics with Bruce Carlson. Bob tells the whole story, and it's fantastic.
Well, thank you, Ben. And Bruce Carlson, by the way, will be joining Ben and I in Mexico in just a few weeks when we do a live Road to Now at the Avett's at the Beach festival coming up.
That's right. I'm so excited about this. Those of you guys who are patrons on Patreon, you've already heard this. We announced it on Patreon a few weeks ago. But this is going to be a lot of fun. We're bringing history. It's our first overseas international Road to Now episode.
It is. And hopefully they'll let us come back to the United States after that. I got a feeling we're going to have trouble getting back through customs. But speaking of international travel and speaking of my button being bigger than yours, or your button being bigger than mine, however it may work out, because there's always a bigger button out there.
Or just being adults and not talking about that stuff.
That's right. Who's our guest today, Ben?
Our guest today is Dr. Joyce Kaufman. She is a professor of political science at Whittier College, and she's a specialist on foreign policy and the history of the United States' role in the world.
Joyce was a wonderful guest, and we tried to go through the history of American foreign policy. We tried to start at the Revolution, really maybe before it a little bit, and kind of work up to present day. It's a kind of an all-encompassing episode.
Right, and we were really looking recently. Mark Landler wrote an op-ed saying that Trump's new foreign policy, which he recently released, is a reversal of the last 70 years of U.S. foreign policy. And so we really wanted to dig into what are the origins of U.S. foreign policy? What was it that brought us to that role for 70 years? And what is Trump's foreign policy? Is it new? What does it look like? And the interesting parallels between now and the 1920s that are revealed by looking at U.S. foreign policy are really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's it's funny because we actually asked that question, you know, about these parallels with the 1920s, and it's really interesting what Dr. Kaufman says. I'll let you hear it for yourself. Here's Joyce Kaufman. Joyce Kaufman, welcome to The Road to Now. Joyce, we not only have you on the show, but it's possible we will have a special appearance by your dog, Seeger. Is that correct? It's a two for one.
Our first interspecies interview on The Road to Now. It's a groundbreaking episode for 2018.
Well, today we're talking about foreign policy and the history of American foreign policy. So when we get into, we just spoke with Robert Mary, who just recently wrote a book about William McKinley. For a future episode coming up here soon. McKinley was, think about, a real foreign relations president. He kind of oversaw this initial bursting of the United States onto the world stage, more of the way we think of it in the 20th century sense. Could you talk about his time in office and the events that led us to be a colonial empire, I guess, in some ways?
Yeah. I think the context becomes especially important here. What we have, because the critical thing with McKinley, obviously, is the Spanish-American War, and that, as you suggested, is the point at which the United States, I would argue, really becomes an imperial power. His priority was American business, and part of that was tied directly to Cuba and U.S. investments in Cuba and Cuban sugar. Now, McKinley was an interesting one because in many ways he had seen the impact of war, the Civil War, on the United States. And so he was less willing to go to war than some others in his administration were, especially people like Roosevelt. And yet it was under McKinley's watch the United States got involved in what became known as war fever, which was fostered in part by William Randolph Hearst, the first time we really see the use of media to really affect public opinion in support of a war. And we also see McKinley fulfilling the promise to protect business as well as to free the Cuban people, as they called it at that point. Now, it's also important to remember that Cuba was within the area defined by the United States as its sphere of influence. And therefore, the idea that the United States had to protect our business in Cuba, but also had to protect and help fight or help protect the civil war that was going on or the rebellion in Cuba at that point was seen as very consistent within U.S. policy because it was within our so-called national interest. So McKinley took a very, and his administration, and clearly it was not just McKinley, a very capacious view of U.S. involvement at that point. And then when the battleship Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor in February of 1898, that provided the excuse to do what many had been wanting to do already, and that was to go ahead to get involved, to intervene in Cuba. And the result was that the United States, at the end of that war, truly was an imperial power, which now had possessions in the Atlantic, Cuba and Puerto Rico, as well as into the Pacific. And so the United States was firmly established at that point, all as a result of this decision to move forward and to expand, again, based on supporting business, but also to ensure that Cuba could be free.
So a lot of our discussion so far has been about the United States national interest, essentially sphere of influence. Some people have referred to, in particular, 19th and 20th century U.S. foreign policy as imperialistic. Would you say, would you agree that that statement works, or does it not? Or how do you feel about that application of the term?
As I look at it, I wouldn't say that the United States specifically pursued an imperialistic foreign policy, especially in the 19th century going up to the Spanish-American War. I would argue that from the perspective of that period of time, what the United States was doing was simply fulfilling what they determined the founders saw as the manifest destiny, the destiny of the United States to expand. I don't think that the founders or the leaders at that time would have seen it as imperialistic the same way they viewed the Europeans and their quest for colonies. I think the United States saw it and probably justified many of these actions based on the need to ensure commercial success, economic success, and trade so that the United States could compete with the other countries at that time. By the time we get to the Spanish-American War, and I do think that at the end of that, we can say the U.S. was an imperialist power in that it too had its colonies and it too had other countries depending upon it, but that the U.S. in turn exploited for its own uses. But I would not say that the U.S. pursued an imperialistic foreign policy as much as one that was simply justified based on what was national interest, especially vis-a-vis where the rest of the world was at that point in time.
Moving forward to 1913, Woodrow Wilson's president, and he reluctantly at first, but ultimately gets him, the United States enters World War I. And at the close of the war, could you maybe talk about that kind of pre-United Nations America global leader moment?
Wilson came into office as president with very much a policy that can be characterized by high-minded ideals, if you will, one that was based on the belief that, well, what we call liberal policy, not liberal conservative, but liberal in the sense of countries will all benefit if they work together. And so part of what Wilson desired to do was to find ways for countries to work together to avoid the horrendous experiences with the First World War. His goal, ideas in formulating or helping to formulate the League of Nations was that countries, when they engage in secret agreements, will move toward situations of war because it fosters mistrust rather than cooperation, which of course the United States was never part of for domestic political reasons.
So I think that's interesting. Like, what part of the American political body was wary of being involved in the League of Nations?
The main reason there was so much concern about it, and it had to do with domestic politics at that point, Article 10 was seen as potentially holding the United States into a position where, in case of war anywhere, it could drag the United States in. Now, in many ways, it's not unlike Article 5 of the NATO Treaty. The attack on one is seen as an attack on all. After the First World War, it was a very politicized environment within the United States. The Republican majority in the Senate at that time opposed the League for that reason. They said this was a way that the United States would end up getting dragged into a future conflict rather than avoiding a future conflict. What we had at that point, again, coming out of a war And as the United States was moving toward a period of isolationism, was the desire to do everything possible to keep the United States out of involvement, and the fear that the League of Nations, again through Article 10, would actually draw the United States into a conflict.
So what's interesting here is that this is inspired largely by America's experience in World War One, and this comes to define American foreign policy for the next two decades and more. Could you talk about how the experience of World War One not only defines policy with the League of Nations, but how it kind of sets the stage for that period of isolationism between World War One and ultimately our entry into World War Two?
Sure. As the United States was coming out of the war, out of World War One, and we get into the 20s, again, we have to look at the domestic priorities and the national interest at that time. The most important priority, the highest priority, and what was seen as being in the national interest was simply staying out of involvement with the United States and focusing inward. And again, the priority at that point, amongst the Republican Senate, the Republican president, was to big business, to economic growth, and to limiting U.S. involvement with the rest of the world. So what we have is a real policies that can best be described as isolationist, turning inward, and doing everything that the United States could to limit involvement with the rest of the world, again, except in some very specific sets of circumstances. So when we look at the context of the 1920s and into the 30s, what we have is not only the U.S. focused inward, but we also have, on the one hand, a period of economic growth domestically. Incomes were rising. The United States, it was a major industrial power at that point. So economically, the United States was doing extremely well, and part of the reason for that was, again, limiting involvement with the rest of the world, which at that point was rather chaotic, especially when we get into the 1930s and what was happening in Asia because of Japan and Europe because of Hitler and Germany. The other side of this, however, is that as a way of limiting U.S. involvement in the rest of the world, the U.S. passed a series of very repressive immigration acts to limit immigrants to the United States as a way of protecting the United States, if you will. It was a time when there was the growth of the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan. In many ways, it was a rather conservative period. It was a period of prohibition. And so we have a country that was really focused inward. And along with that came some tendencies that, in retrospect, ended up being really detrimental to our cultural and social growth of this country.
Are we seeing a parallel moment today?
That's what I was just thinking.
As I talk about this, as I read about it, as I think about it, it seems to be eerily similar in some ways. The nationalism that we've seen recently, the anti-immigrant fervor that we've seen, the desire to turn away from multilateral agreements, to focus inwardly, if you will, is very similar to what happened in the 20s. Now, obviously, we don't know the long-term impact. We do know what happened after some of these policies in the 20s, which contributed to short-term economic growth. And eventually, we ended up in a depression, a global depression, which led to other horrendous circumstances. But yes, it seems to be very similar in some ways.
Ramza Records, David Childers reteams with producer Don Dixon for Run Skeleton Run. The lauded North Carolina singer-songwriter's latest effort features vocals and banjo contributions by Scott Avett of the Avett Brothers. Road to Now listeners can even get a 20% off discount on David Childers' new album by using the promo code HISTORY at RamzaRecords.com.
Do we jump right now to the Mark Landler column, his great column, Trump, the Insurgent Breaks with 70 Years of American Foreign Policy, which Joyce, you sent to us.
Well, no, I think this is actually a brilliant segue, because the question becomes, you know, if we've broken with 70 years of foreign policy and we're seeing, you know, parallels between today and the 1920s, could you explain what is it that happens that takes us from after World War II? Of course, World War II draws us in. What is it that whisks us to that level of foreign involvement for 70 years that we're now seeing a break with?
When we look at the Cold War and the end of the Second World War, the United States clearly emerged as a major power. The Soviet Union at that point was lagging behind the U.S., but became the other major superpower. Obviously, what we all know about the division of the world into the two camps, the East and West, each anchored by the United States in the West and the Soviet Union in the East. And that became a framework for basically foreign policy from 1945 or 46 to 1991 with the end of the Soviet Union. As difficult and tension-filled as that period was in many ways. And, you know, we can look at things like the Cuban Missile Crisis and the idea that we were eyeball to eyeball on the brink of nuclear war and actually were able to resolve that. That period was filled with tension, was fraught with tension, but in many ways it was also very predictable. Neither side would want to go beyond a certain point. There was a lot of posturing back and forth, as we know. And that led us to a period of what's been known as the long peace, the period of relative stability. This does not mean it was free of conflict. There were conflicts, the 1950s, 60s, wars of national liberation, all of that, but they were somewhat contained. As we get to the post-Cold War period, it was characterized by the period of globalization. Basically, it was the recognition that this period of Cold War division is now being replaced by a period of interaction, of interdependence. In many ways, it's the polar opposite of isolationism. It's the desire for countries to be engaged with one another and to be part of the very interdependent world, the world in which, to use a cliche, rising tide lifts all boats. And then we get to a period where we see the emergence of more terrorist groups. Obviously, 9/11 is the example of that. The growth of non-state actors, not only terrorist groups, but multinational corporations, NGOs. So the basically framework within which foreign policy is conducted has changed dramatically, and that's what really gets us to the current period. Throughout this whole time, from 1945 to the present, one of the givens was the role of the United States. Not only during the Cold War, but after the Cold War, the whole period of globalization, in many ways, was characterized by the emerging role of U.S. corporations, the tendency to often conflate globalization with westernization, with Americanization. They were often seen as much the same thing, which in many ways to me signifies the important role that the United States played, the dominant role the United States played. When you get to the present, And the Trump administration, and the Landler article is really excellent as a description of that. What we have is the United States suddenly changing the role it has played. Now, I mean, one could argue that what the United States has been doing is abrogating its role as leader internationally, and in so doing, allowing other countries, most notably China, to really emerge and fill a void that the United States seems to be leaving behind. And that's where I think we if we look at U.S. foreign policy today and we look at international relations today writ large, we're looking at a period of change and turbulence, in part because of the changing role of the United States and in part because of uncertainty about what the United States is going to do, what that's going to mean for other countries' policies, and what that's going to mean for a changing balance of power.
The Mark Landler article, which we will post for everyone to see, is brilliant. It begins where he describes a brooding, angry President Trump walking through the brand new headquarters, the cathedral-like atrium of the brand new headquarters of NATO, and just seething at all the glass walls and how beautiful it is, and thinking about how much money it costs, and just getting angrier and angrier and angrier. Putting Trump's personality aside, because he's such a divisive figure, did Obama in some way begin this differently, but begin this idea of America being a little more inward? Because I say this because in the run-up to the 2008 election, I had a friend of mine who worked for a conservative think tank, and he was furious about the prospect of a President Obama. He said, because he will make America a smaller presence on the world stage. That was his big fear. And now you have conservatives, you know, many of them falling in line behind President Trump's form of isolationism. Did Obama begin this in some ways?
I think one of the most interesting things about the Obama presidency, if you look back at some of the Pew polls, the early polls about the Pew Global Attitude polls, simply the election of Obama changed the way in which the rest of the world perceived the United States. So, again, putting Obama's election into context, coming at a time after there was so much division coming out of the George W. Bush administration, the decision to go into Iraq, the ongoing challenges that grew from that, the fights with our allies about that, simply Obama's election changed perception. And that right away, I think, sets the tone for the Obama administration. I think that the Obama administration is fairly interesting in some ways. And, you know, admittedly, I have a bias here because I think Obama did a lot of things to reinstate U.S. position and prestige, especially at a time when the United States perception was relatively low. I mean, he, early in his administration, early in his presidency, he gave two speeches, one in Istanbul and one in Cairo, both of which were specifically designed to reinforce U.S. relationships with the Muslim world. Both of them were really designed to distinguish between the people and those small fringe groups who perpetrated terrorist acts as a way of showing the United States does not condemn a group of people. And I think that kind of very positive outreach, values-driven perception helped the United States. Now, that said, I also think there were things that the Obama administration where they didn't go far enough, where they didn't do enough. I think Syria is an example of that. I mean, we're still living with the aftermath of Syria. We have issues continuing with Iraq, with Afghanistan. Now, again, admittedly, Obama inherited those, but perhaps there was more that could have been done. You know, I don't know. It's always easy in retrospect to say, oh, if only they had done ABC, things would have been different. I think Syria was an opportunity that was not taken. Perhaps Obama was too timid at that point. I don't know. But I think that there are things that one can point to that at least perceptions of the United States were strengthened. And what I tell my class is perceptions become reality. And Ben, you know, you're an academic, you teach, you know how students think about these things. And when I tell my students perceptions become reality, what I mean is that if the United States is perceived as taking a lead role, as being important, other countries will respond to the United States in that way. And I think that's one of the things that Obama was able to do in his administration.
Again, to the Mark Landler op-ed, there's a scene where President Trump is with Angela Merkel, and he says, I want to renegotiate. I want to do a bilateral agreement with Germany instead of one with the EU. And Merkel, trying to be respectful, lets him know that, you know, we can do a bilateral agreement, but it'll be between the United States and Europe. And he says, well, then fine. I want to do a bilateral. Like, he completely, you say perception is reality. Well, we have a president who is aloof to the 70 years of history that he's changing, that he's completely turning around, turning on its ear. What is that perception like, you know, for us now and the rest of the world? And what is happening to the State Department, the crown jewel of American foreign policy?
Yeah, I think I found that point that you highlighted from the Landler article to be absolutely fascinating. I think clearly it shows a number of things. One is, I mean, the president's lack of understanding about big picture kinds of issues pertaining to foreign policy and what the basic of foreign policy is really about. But I think it also suggests how in many ways leadership is shifting. Now, Merkel at this point is under pressure. She hasn't yet formed a government, at least not as of today, that last time I had looked. So she's under pressure, but it is clear that within the European community, she is the leader. She is the one people are now looking to. And the fact that she was able to figure out how to respond to that question in a way that saved a certain amount of face for the United States really is a credit to her and to her abilities as a political leader. That in many ways gets to your question about what's going on with the State Department, with diplomacy in general in the United States. In fact, the State Department had always been the crown jewel. I mean, the United States always, I mean, going back to the start of the country when we had people like Benjamin Franklin, who was ambassador, this was an opportunity to really showcase the best and the brightest of the United States had. And every one of the members of the diplomatic corps serves as a representative of, and in many ways, the embodiment of the United States. The fact that that's being cut, to me, suggests, again, the lack of importance or undercutting the role that the United States is playing internationally. If the United States is truly going to remain a leader, the United States has to be able to get people out there on the ground, in the State Department, in embassies, who really can represent the United States and who can lead. I was just looking over the national security strategy that Trump put out, the Trump administration put out recently, and one of the major points is we will advance American influence because a world that supports American interests and reflects our values makes America more secure and prosperous. And yet the United States can't advance influence or our role without having people who understand how to do that. So that would be my take on that.
You speak about the diplomacy through the State Department, and that is certainly important. The other side has to do with our military policy. And one of the questions I have is about NATO, which is one of your specialties. The Trump administration has criticized NATO fairly consistently and has talked about pulling out or cutting funding for it. Now, NATO was created as a counterbalance to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union had the Warsaw Pact. When the Cold War ended, a lot of people suggested that perhaps NATO should end. What do you think about that? Do you think that NATO has a continued role, or that Trump is perhaps right that today's world does not need a NATO?
I personally do believe that NATO continues and is relevant in part because it's been able to adapt. So back in the day when Clinton was one of the first ones to talk about NATO expansion, and there was a lot of questions about the wisdom of that at the time, and I was one of those who was very skeptical. But one of the things about the expansion of NATO that was most important, I think, was it brought the countries of the former Eastern European bloc firmly into line with Western Europe. And so, again, symbolically, politically, as well as militarily, by bringing in Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, and then the other countries that followed, what you have is really an assertion that the Cold War had ended and that all of these countries that had been communist, had been part of the communist bloc, were really democratic, capitalist countries that were further interconnected. So that's the first thing that I think was important about making NATO relevant. The second thing was former Yugoslavia. And that was really, a traumatic time for NATO, because NATO did not know how to respond. In fact, I don't think a lot of countries knew how to respond. I mean, for the United States, it was very easy to say, oh, it's a European problem, it needs a European solution. However, it became clear it was much more than that. And it was only after NATO got involved that the situation on the ground changed enough to lead to the Dayton Agreement. That was really an out-of-area fight for NATO, and again, was a rethinking of NATO's role. And the last and perhaps most important to me example of the changing role of NATO and its relevance is the fact that it was engaged in Afghanistan. And I mean, this is a completely out of area role, but it's also an example of how an alliance, a group of countries, can work together to pursue common goals. And again, this is important militarily, but especially politically. And I think that's where NATO has really shown the important role it has and can continue to play.
What would you say to people who would counter that it has perhaps been one of the largest problems for U.S.-Russian relations?
Well, I mean, I think it's been a problem for U.S.-Russian relations from the time it was created in 1949.
Right.
You know, there's nothing new here. I think if it's any more of a problem now, it's only because Russia is trying to expand, and with that, what it did in Ukraine and Crimea. And with that, there's always the possibility that NATO will, in fact, play a more aggressive role. So I'm not sure it's any different. Perhaps Russia's intentions are different now, which might make it seem more threatening to Russia now than it has for a while. But I don't think otherwise there's any real significant change.
Joyce, Ben and I were talking before we got on the phone with you, and we realized that American foreign policy began long before our Constitution was written. Can you maybe take us back to some of the earliest forms and interactions of American government with foreign nations?
Sure. I think, you know, everybody who studied American history knows the history of the country and how basically our first major foreign policy decision was to break from the United Kingdom, the Revolutionary War, clearly. And that was really the start of the country, which had to do with the understanding that the framers had of the role of this new country in a world where often the European countries were beset by war and competition, and especially as a newly formed country, the priority was to ensure that the country could stabilize and grow. So out of that Revolutionary War and the fight with Britain for independence came a desire to establish the country as an independent entity that could make its place in the world. And the belief was the best way to do so was, in George Washington's words, to steer clear of entangling alliances. So really the earliest U.S. foreign policy was for the United States to be very careful in the types of engagement it had with other countries and to pick and choose the times at which the U.S. would engage with other countries, which primarily pertain to trade and commerce, so tied to economic development, and the rest of the time to remain aloof from those interactions as a way of ensuring U.S. protection for itself in a rather turbulent world.
Which is an interesting change since the first major priority of the new U.S. government when it became independent was to make an alliance with France, right?
Correct. And the alliance with France, again, was seen as something that was in the best interest of the United States, in part as a way of balancing the power of Britain. This was a time of great, well, they weren't even great powers, but of competition and changing relationships. And for the United States, it really was deciding when, where, and under what set of circumstances to engage with other countries. So in fact, while the U.S. did have an early alliance with France, it was really our ties to Great Britain and especially economic support that later came from Britain that helped the United States to actually grow and develop. So the U.S. had a very interesting relationship with those European powers, which in many ways we can say continues to the present time.
What about foreign policy when we talk about the War of 1812? You talk about this very important relationship that the United States has always had with Great Britain, but it was tested very early on. What were some of the foreign policy blunders and successes that went in around that time period of the War of 1812?
Well, first of all, when we look at that period of time, I think we have to, again, put it in context. First of all, the United States and the founders, the founding fathers, because they were all men at that point, really believed in the importance of, first of all, protecting the country, but also fulfilling our destiny, the whole notion of manifest destiny. And part of that, as the United States was thinking about it and thinking about how to do so, the U.S. also had to deal with realities of Europe at that point. And we had a Europe that was immersed in wars. You had Napoleon. You had a lot of competition at that point. And the United States was, in fact, really, its priority was to protect itself. At that point, the United States was growing as far as the naval power. Part of that came from the belief that if the United States was going to expand, it really needed to have a navy because trade was critically important. And what we had was a direct conflict at that point with Britain, which was the major naval power at that time. You had Britain and France competing for territory in North America, and the United States trying to establish itself and its role. The War of 1812, in many ways, was an early defeat for the United States and a reminder of the fact that it still was a young country, a growing country. And yet, in many ways, it also allowed the United States to sort of flex its own power, albeit in a very minor kind of way.
And leading into that, you talk about maybe a minor defeat in some ways. Not too long after the War of 1812, around 1823, we had the Monroe Doctrine, which we could do a whole series of shows on.
Yeah, we could.
So maybe just for our listeners, explain what it was and how it shaped the next 150 years of American foreign policy in our region.
Sure. By the time we get out of the War of 1812 and the United States is really starting to establish itself, it became clear at that point that the future and the success of the United States depended on its ability to grow and expand in the Western Hemisphere. Part of what we have, and probably the first assertion of that as a critical factor, was the Monroe Doctrine. It was done in 1823. It really guided U.S. foreign policy, as you noted, for quite a period of time after that. The Monroe Doctrine itself was an address to the Congress, and it outlined for the Congress, but also for other countries, because I believe strongly that these addresses to the Congress, presidential addresses, have multiple audiences. And in this case, the audience was not only the Congress, but clearly other countries. And what Monroe did is he made it clear that the United States would stay removed from European affairs. But in turn, the European powers were expected to stay out of North America, out of the New World. And that was a declaration of this continent as within the U.S. sphere of influence. So what it did is it basically made a statement to the European powers that this continent is no longer open to colonization, but in fact, it is really U.S. territory and part of the future of the United States, still a very young country, was to expand westward on our continent, which the United States did and led us into the Mexican-American War, various purchases, et cetera. And so what we have is the United States from that declaration in 1823 to basically 1848, the United States expanding across the continent as it had declared it would do.
And finally, I want to ask you the question we ask everybody. Dr. Kaufman, you have a PhD in political science. You have written textbooks on the subject. You are a highly renowned figure in your field. How did you get there? What made you start? What drove you to pursue a career as a political scientist?
Do you want the long answer? I'll be really honest. When I went to NYU NYU as an undergraduate, I came into college as an English major. I had a really lousy English teacher and a great political science teacher with whom I am still in touch. He has long since retired, but I was fascinated by it, by trying to understand why countries do what they do. Why does the world work in the way in which it works? And I was doing a PhD at the University of Maryland. As I was finishing up, I was invited to apply for an mid-level internship at the Department of Defense, and I did it. I thought, well, if I'm going to study this, I might as well see how policy is really made.
Right.
And I spent 3 years at DOD. I did NATO nuclear policy, which was a real eye-opener because it's nothing like the way I was taught about how policy is supposed to work. And I then worked for defense contractors before I decided that the real reason I got a PhD was to teach. That's what brought me back to the academic world. But I think in many ways, my teaching has clearly been informed by the fact that I actually spent some time working in the real world and being able to make a distinction between the way the world is supposed to work, the way policy is supposed to be made, and the way in which it really is.
That is beautiful. The gap between theory and practice is oftentimes a wide one.
Absolutely.
Well, Joyce Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you have a great 2018.
Thank you so much, Joyce.
Thanks so much to both of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. The Road to Now is hosted by Bob Crawford and Benjamin Sawyer and produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Our associate editor is Megan Summers. Today's music is by Paul Autofiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Eric King, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, and Jeff LeCain. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and it does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care.